You're listening to an encore presentation of Unreserved. Danse Anine, Bujou, hello and welcome. This is Unreserved. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. Whether it's novels, comics, or games, fantasy fiction lets us create any world we can imagine. From deep space to Middle Earth to kingdoms in faraway lands. Often these worlds feature a battle between good and evil, the hero's journey, and one side conquering the other. Not often found in these worlds is the indigenous worldview. But these indigenous creatives are flipping the narrative, centering indigenous characters, and changing fantasy tropes. Anishinaabe Kwe author Melissa Blair wrote her first book to challenge the conquering hero trope in fantasy romance.
There wasn't a dissection of monarchy and imperialism and colonialism at all in these stories. It was just that typical fantasy lens of, okay, the princess is going to get really good with a sword and win her throne back.
Instead, a broken blade landed her a 4-part series book deal. And a world without colonialism? Connor Alexander created the role-playing game Coyote and Crow to give Indigenous kids a hopeful world where they see themselves.
Coyote and Crow was a chance for me to say, hey, here's a really optimistic future, and try to find a way to create a game that people could play in that future and tell stories in that future.
Plus, Indigenous Australian Scott Wilson created the Indigiverse comic series, where First Nations people are the superheroes.
It was like my ancestors reached down, reached out of the dreaming, and tapped me on the shoulder and said, we have this story you need to bring to life. We have a universe that we want you to share stories through.
Today, Indigenous storymakers who are indigenizing the fantasy genre. Crack open a popular fantasy novel, and you'll likely find a sword-wielding hero, a swooning love interest, and a kingdom that must be reclaimed from a powerful evil ruler. But where in this world is the Indigenous worldview? Well, Melissa Blair puts an Indigenous two-spirit spin on the fantasy romance genre. The queer Anishinaabe Kwe writer self-published her first novel, A Broken Blade, in 2021. Its success landed her a publishing deal for a 4-book series called The Halfling Saga. The 4th and final book, An Honored Vow, is out now. Melissa, welcome to Unreserved.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Now, when you started reading fantasy romance, what kind of characters and narratives did you notice in these books?
Yeah, I started reading fantasy romance a lot during the pandemic. It blew up on the internet and a whole bunch of us were reading it. I really liked the subgenre a lot, but I did find that a lot of the main characters were white main characters who were either conquerors themselves or the descendants of conquerors in these fantasy lands. And oftentimes the plot was focused around them reclaiming a throne, with some mention of, you know, the people who used to live on these lands, but of course no mention of where those people went and what happened to them and do they still exist now? And Indigenous characters were always an afterthought or very rarely mentioned. And if they were, it was always ornamental. And they were never a side character, let alone a main character. So I decided to put my own Indigenous spin on the genre.
Yes, and I love that. As you said, fantasy is so often set in, you know, a kingdom, a lost kingdom, an empire, a crumbling empire. How do these books depict rulers and empires in their narratives?
Fantasy is such a wide genre in and of itself. There's so much anti-colonial and Indigenous-focused fantasy that you can find. But in this subgenre of fantasy romance that blew up so quickly, a lot of the kingdoms and things that we were seeing was based from the protagonist's point of view. Like, they were the royalty of the kingdom, and that was the lens that the entire story was told from. There wasn't a dissection of monarchy and imperialism and colonialism at all in these stories. It was just that typical fantasy lens of, okay, the princess is going to get really good with a sword and win her throne back.
I always wanted to be good with a sword. I'm not going to lie.
Me too. I'm not very good with a sword, but maybe one day.
Poetry arms. I can't hold on to swords. I understand that you first got the idea to write one of these books through being on TikTok, or rather book talk.
Yes.
Can you tell us how you found your way there?
Yeah. So again, we have to go back to 2020 when we're all locked inside, and I was quarantining on my own. So I had a lot of free time, and I, like a lot of us did, I downloaded this app called TikTok that everyone was raving about. And very quickly, TikTok figured out that I was quite the book nerd and I read constantly, and it put me on this sub-community on the app called Book Talk, which was just brand new. I think I joined Book Talk when it was about 2 weeks old.
Oh, wow.
It had just become a community. Yeah. This is where I started learning about the genre of fantasy romance, and I started watching all these videos and recommendations, and I was reading these books so I could comment on other people's videos. But I also found that no one was talking about Indigenous books on Book Talk. No one was reading them. So then I slowly started posting videos of my own talking about these other books that I was reading, novels and nonfiction by Indigenous authors, and getting other people to read them. And slowly I amassed a following that way. And then in the background kind of just decided like, I think Book Talk might be interested in this kind of story.
Yeah.
And then use that to launch my fantasy series.
So how did you go from talking about, you know, Indigenous authors and books and storylines to actually publishing your first book?
It was a mix of confidence and pandemic delusion, I think.
Thank God for delusion.
Yeah. some pandemic optimism. And I learned about on TikTok, there's also this part of the community that's author talk. And there were these authors who were talking about self-publishing and how you didn't have to go to a publisher to get your books published. You could publish yourself. And I never really thought of that or known that as a viable option of publishing. And I had this idea for this fantasy romance series, which was so different from anything I'd ever thought I'd wanted to write before, because I've always wanted to be an author. I just never thought I'd write in this subgenre. So I thought self-publishing might be a really great way to get the books out quickly, to share it with what I thought was just going to be this group of people I've found on the internet. The funny thing is I decided not to tell anyone online or even in my real life that I was working on this book and I was planning on self-publishing it. I kept that secret for 6 months, wrote the book, got it professionally edited, got a cover for it, figured out how to self-publish. And then I published it anonymously, and I sent out all of these book boxes to different book talkers, some of whom were mutuals of mine who had no idea it was me who was sending it, some of whom who had never heard of me on Book Talk at all. And I sent them a book with this anonymous, a broken blade copy with a letter that said, a book talker wrote this book. There's a code at the end of this letter. You have to read the book to figure it out. And it took the whole Book Talk community about 2 weeks to figure out who I was. And I sold a whole bunch of copies of the book as an anonymous version. And people started reading it all Christmas long. And then finally, they decoded the message, which took them a little bit of a long time because I put a little bit of Anishinaabemowin into it. Mm. And no one could use their computers to crack it. They had to do it manually. And then, yeah, they revealed it was me. And then I self-published it with my own name. But it didn't last very long because about 2 weeks after that, I had a book deal.
Wow.
And now I've been traditionally published.
Incredible. What was the reaction from, you know, the Book Talk community to your book before and after they revealed it was you?
Thankfully, they liked it. I guess I gave myself an out. If people really hated it, I wouldn't have had to reveal myself. I didn't get any negative feedback or anything when it was revealed to be me. It's pretty evident for people who read the book that it was likely to be, you know, an Indigenous person or someone with direct connection and understanding of colonialism on Turtle Island or in North America. So I think people had narrowed it down to a list of, you know, potential Indigenous or Black book talkers that they thought could have written the book. So I was definitely on a few guest lists.
Well, that's good.
Yeah, people had narrowed it down.
Let's talk a little bit about the series itself. Where are you taking us here in the Halfling saga?
In this world, there are humans that have come to this magical land that is filled with elves and fae, and they start taking over the land and start pushing the fae onto one little piece of land on the continent, and they have killed a lot of the elves in the war that took place. Now, this book is told several hundred years in the future through the lens of Kira, who is a halfling, meaning she's part mortal, part elf. Her people are not seen as citizens under the king's rule. Her people are seen as wards of the crown, and because of that, she has to work for the king, and her job in particular is being part of his police force, his task force, and she's a very skilled assassin, and she has a lot of power under the king's rule, which she is secretly using to try to help as many halflings as she can while still being in this position of basically colonial authority. And the books are her journey from leaving that role behind and fully kind of rebelling against the crown while making connections with her true kin that are still living in the Feyland. And you see her deal with that guilt and deal with that trauma, but also grow and heal and find a community throughout all four books. And then, of course, it has some really fun magic and girls with swords and all the fun stuff that people love in fantasy romance.
And who are the indigenous people in your story?
In the books, the indigenous people are the first people of the land, which in this book are the elves and then the fae, and they have their own culture and their own understanding and lore and histories that are being suppressed by the king who has come over, who is non-magical mortal, which is meant to be, it was inspired for me of how white settlers came over to Turtle Island and started colonizing. Mm-hmm. Of course, I'm not saying that our people have magical powers, but this is a fantasy novel, so I gave some people some fun abilities.
Speaking of colonization, how did you approach writing about that in a fantasy genre?
Yeah, I really wanted to make that a main theme of the book. I do find that it's a theme that's getting tackled a lot in the broader genre of fantasy, but in fantasy romance in particular, at least the books that were very popular, it wasn't being tackled in the same way. It is now, thankfully, in 5 years, like it's been quite a jump that I'm so happy to see. But I wanted to do two things. I wanted to make it evident in the story through the main character, but also all the other characters that she meets and deals with, that you get all the different facets of what this kind of trauma can do to people. People who experienced that colonization firsthand, and then the descendants of those people, and what that means, not just a loss of land, but a loss of language and a loss of culture and a loss of teaching and a loss of kinship. And also for some people, a loss of bloodline, like not even knowing who your parents are. All of these things happen in their own way in the book, and it's all connected to the plot. Just because I think that's something that as Indigenous people, we experience a lot and it doesn't get to be explored. So that was one thing that I really want to tell throughout this series. And then the other thing that I wanted to focus on, which is done through the main character a lot, is the difficult situations that Indigenous people get put in colonization at times, where you feel like you only have two bad choices in front of you. Neither are good choices for your people or for your spirit at all, but you have to make one, and you're put in these situations that wouldn't exist without colonization. And that's very much the place where Kira is at the start of the series, where she's grappling with, I don't even know how to do the right thing, and trying to forge her own way to get to that truth of feeling comfortable with where she's at and the decision she can make and has available to her. So I wanted to tackle moral grayness, which is this thing that people love to write about and read about in the subgenre. I wanted to do that, but in a way that felt really grounded to what I've experienced, what my family's experienced. And then other things, like in fantasy and in this subgenre, there's a lot of things that could be connected to generational trauma, you know, like loss of language or even, you know, substance abuse or disconnection with family members. But it's kind of treated as this one quick plot that gets sorted really quickly or never gets touched on again. And I wanted that to be something that is being explored for all four books and is a constant struggle with each of these characters who struggle with these different things. Mm-hmm. Because at least in my experience, those things don't just go away when the plot is like, okay, we can put that away now.
Right, right. How did you, you know, ensure that you were writing these stories in sort of a trauma-informed way and you weren't using that experience, that negative trauma experience as, you know, entertainment, which is, you know, also a big concern for some?
That was really important to me. One of the things I did is I made sure I put a content warning at the beginning of the book so people are aware exactly what you're getting into and you can make that judgment about whether it's safe or not for you to read that book at that time or at all. And then during the writing of the books, I worked directly with someone who helped me frame out the main character's experience with PTSD and substance abuse. She's an alcoholic. Just to make sure that that made sense to the story, it wasn't being over dramatic for no reason, and it felt honest and it was based in true experience. And then with each book, sensitivity readers go through and make sure that experience has come through in what I've written, and to make sure there's nothing too triggering or that doesn't come off the way I intend for it to come off. And then if there is anything that could be triggering that I haven't noticed, they also help me put together that content warning. So if it stays in the book, I can make sure to warn people ahead of time that it's in there.
That's wonderful care that you took with your readers and your audience. What kind of difference do you think, you know, having books like The Halfling Saga would have made for a little Melissa as you, you know, as a young book nerd looking for representation and herself in these pages?
I mean, I would have loved it. My representation was Jacob Black in the Twilight series, which is not the best Indigenous representation that exists.
I was still team Jacob, like, though.
Yeah, exactly.
Except near the end. Then it got really weird, but this is another conversation.
Really weird, but the idea of young Melissa being able to read young adult fantasy that had Indigenous characters in the books at all, let alone main characters, I think that would have just turned my world upside down. Mm. It would have been so special. And I'm so happy that today that is a reality. You can go into bookstores, you can go into libraries, and you can see Indigenous people on the covers of books and Indigenous characters in books. And the representation is done well and is done by Indigenous people instead of people co-opting entire nations to make their books seem more interesting.
Mm. And what are your hopes for the future, you know, of fantasy and Indigenous people writing and entering this genre?
Yeah, I hope that more and more Indigenous people write as many stories as they want to write. I'm really excited that we're in a place where publishers are excited to publish Indigenous authors who might not want to write those Indigenous stories that the publishing house has only been interested in publishing for a long time. Like, they're important, you know, of course, stories about residential school, for example. But there's Indigenous writers who also want to write science fiction and super fantasy and, you know, funny little kids books and stuff like that. And I think we're finally seeing the publishing industry start to take Indigenous authors across the board in that way. So I'm really excited to see what people do across all of these genres and how they indigenize it and take it back. Mm-hmm. So that's what I'm hoping to see is Indigenous writers on the bookshelves of every bookshelf. Turtle Island representation on every bookshelf in the bookstore. Yeah.
Poetry arms up. Yay. Well, thank you so much for your time today, Melissa.
Thank you for having me.
Melissa Blair is the author of The Halfling Saga. She is Anishinaabekwe from Treaty 9 territory. You're listening to Unreserved on CBC Radio 1, Sirius XM, US Public Radio, and Native Voice 1. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. Still ahead.
I don't want natives to have to face the stuff that we're always having to face every day with residential schools and missing and murdered Indigenous women. I don't want that to be part of my game. So it took an alternate timeline to do that.
Connor Alexander wants Indigenous kids to see and play themselves in a hopeful future without the historical harms. Taking us there, this is Zune with their song, Dodum. That was Zune with their song Dotem. You're listening to Unreserved on CBC Radio 1, Sirius XM, U.S. Public Radio, and Native Voice 1. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. Where would pop culture be without superheroes? Our screens are full of movies and shows about cape crusaders, webheads, and demigods. Scott Wilson created his own superhero universe, the Indigiverse.
We have this huge library of superheroes. We have Dreamwalker, Janama, the Guardian, Switch, the Outcast.
Scott is Gooniyandi and Gadgarong from Northwest Australia. Growing up, he loved superhero comics. So much so, when he was 13 years old, he dreamt up Darkheart, a Gooniyandi ancestor misplaced in time who is learning his language, gets advice from elders, and has powers tied to his culture. Darkheart became the first Indigiverse character to get his own comic. The character represents some of the challenges of growing up away from language and culture, and he champions a bigger future where Indigenous people are the keepers and tellers of their own stories.
Junangaragili, Yaningi, Giliyani. Good day, everyone. Nganyagili, Scott Wilson, Nganyagili, Gooniyandi, Ngadjurong, Yulu, Gawa, Nikuru. My name is Scott Wilson, and I'm a Gooniyandi and Gadjurong man from the northwest of Western Australia, known as the Kimberley. But for all those out there listening from outside of Australia, I am currently sharing from Western Australia. And I am the co-founder, co-creator of a very new comic universe called the Indigiverse. So Darkheart is actually the first introduction into our superhero universe. And Darkheart is actually a young person going through the ins and outs of life and the challenges that comes with, you know, trying to find oneself, but also the responsibility to save the planet by the powers of the dreaming. When we talk about the dreaming, especially as First Nations peoples here in Australia, we don't look at the dreaming as mythology. For us as Aboriginal people, the dreaming is existing right now. It's the continuation of stories that exist within an understanding of past, present, and the future. Our main protagonist is able to physically maneuver between Western time, or what we perceive as reality, into the dreaming, which is coexisting with Western time. It's just like the veil, you know, when we talk about purgatory and these kind of spaces. While the dreaming is existing right now, we just can't see it, or we haven't learned the abilities to see the dreaming. And with 65,000-year-old knowledge and connection, you know, we have our elder protectors alongside Adam Heart, which is Darkheart, being able to have that knowledge to see into the dreaming and actually use it, the power of the dreaming, for good. Darkheart actually started with my whole journey of being displaced, leaving home and leaving family, leaving culture, and my journey to ensuring that my identity is strong and that I, yeah, give back to my community. I was sent away from where I grew up, which is Yarru Jugin country in Broome, Western Australia, and flown thousands of kilometers all the way to Wajak Budja, Burraloo, which is in Perth. And it was there that I spent a lot of time with these ideas and these stories that have been inspired and influenced by my elders and the sharing of oral tradition that has been passed on generation to generation. And it was like my ancestors reached down, reached out of the dreaming and tapped me on the shoulder and said, we have this story you need to bring to life. We have a universe that we want you to share stories through. That's where the story of Darkheart actually started to form, and it was based on my lived experience, right? And so we have a young person here, Darkheart, much like myself, who was taken from his home, put into a different environment, And I feel like that's the journey for a lot of young people. You know, we've been given this responsibility from our parents, from our community. How do we take that and use that as a driver, not to put these expectations on ourselves, but to use it as empowerment to go, you know what, I'm on my hero's journey and I'm going to kill it. I'm going to smash it. I'm going to take all these responsibility and use it to actually thrive. As a young fella, I struggled to read. But when it came to actually reading comic books, which I discovered very young, the stories came much easier and it came much easier to retain. You know, I'd be looking at the panels, creating my own stories. Language and incorporating that aspect into the Indigiverse was priority number one. I believe I used the comic books to amplify my needs to learn my language. I had always struggled with my mental health and my social-emotional well-being. And when you look at this aspect of a whole-of-life approach or the holistic understanding of the world that we have as Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples, you can see the connections that we need to have and the disconnect that is there from seven different connections across our lifespan, and one of which is the connection to your culture. And that became a part of the process. So sitting down with my jubby, so my grandfather, Mervyn Street, sitting down with my judges or my nanas, anywhere that I could connect to my language, I had to take that opportunity. When you pick up your first issue of Darkheart, you will see that within the books, the conversations, it's normalized in the behaviors of our characters. So we have the characters that don't know our language, but then for the Elder Protectors, they all speak fluently Aboriginal language. We have captions. So any conversations that is had in language will be captioned in its English form. And then at the back of the book, we share a glossary of each of those language words and what they mean. For instance, our new comic book, Dreamwalker, our first female superhero in the Indigiverse, has over 80 Gunyindi words in one comic book, in conversation, in talking. In Australia, we say we yarn. A lot of yarning is happening in our language, that you all can be a part of that yarn. This might just seem like comics, but it's part of a bigger future. We need that representation in the world that is governed by and led by First Nations peoples in this telling and sharing of their own stories. We come from a huge history where stories are only told by the conquerors. And here we are reinstating that right to share our own stories, but also sharing the endless possibilities that come with our ideologies, that is about community, that is about the collective, that is about a more ecocentric view of the world than an anthropocentric view. It is about coming together, you know, and I feel like this holistic understanding of the world needs to be shared, and we can embody that and share that through the movement of creating these spaces that are First Nations led. I honestly do not see a future where it's just First Nations peoples owning everything. It is in collaboration and along the lines of who we are as Aboriginal people, which is about community and working together and walking together. That's what it's all about. It's about your heart and your spirit, and that is exactly what we're creating here with the Indigiverse.
Scott Wilson is the creator of the Indigiverse. He is Gunyindi and Gadgarong and lives in Perth, Australia. This is Unreserved on CBC Radio 1, Sirius XM, US Public Radio, and Native Voice 1. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. Let's step back in time, about 700 years. European colonizers are about to set sail for North America. But then a flash of purple light crosses the sky. The world is plunged into darkness, and a different world takes shape. A world where Turtle Island was never colonized. There are new nations, new treaties, new technologies, even new superhuman powers. Welcome to the alternate universe of Coyote and Crow. It's a role-playing game like Dungeons & Dragons, created by Connor Alexander. He is a citizen of the Cherokee Nation of Oklahoma. Connor, welcome to Unreserved.
Osio, thank you so much for having me, Roseanne. It's really nice to be here.
Well, it's nice to have you here. So let's start with taking us into the world of Coyote and Crow. Could you describe the world that you've created?
Yeah, so I'll borrow a phrase that I did not invent, but is used to sort of describe these kinds of things sometimes, which is indigenous futurisms. It's the idea of looking forward while still including the past. And, you know, obviously for Native peoples, traditions in the past are very important. But I think sometimes we have so many things to look at and so many things to deal with in our current and present day that sometimes we don't get to maybe look at an optimistic future as often as we could. So Coyote and Crow was a chance for me to say, hey, here's a really optimistic future, and try to find a way to create a game that people could play in that future and tell stories in that future.
And what does this future look like, or this alternate future rather, look like?
Well, it's certainly not free of conflict. There's a lot of drama to be had, which is what you want in a role-playing game, right? Like, you want some excitement and some adventure. But I think the things that I've tried to present in this game that are different from what we have to deal with is we built a world out that has housing for everyone. It has education for everyone. It has healthcare for everyone. It has a completely different justice system and ideas about community and what it means to be a community and work together as a community. That doesn't take away from all of the core things we deal with as human beings, whether it's greed or jealousy or murder and all the other things that make a good drama, right? Mm-hmm. But I wanted to create an environment where natives didn't have to deal with colonial trauma at every single turn.
Mm. And for someone who may have, you know, never played a role-playing game,
Yeah. Tell
us, you know, the basics of how the game works.
Well, it's what I like to call collaborative storytelling. The idea is one player or one person playing the game, which we call the story guide, helps set the stage. They describe the environment. They describe the weather, the antagonists, the challenges and the dilemmas, while players create an individual single character. Think of it almost like a character in a stage play. But it's improv, right? You get to decide what your character likes and doesn't like, what they're good at, what they enjoy, and what their relationships are to the other characters at the table. And together they face challenges guided by the story guide. He's trying to help provide a fun and engaging story, one that will hopefully, at the end of the day, leave all the players and the story guide with a fascinating story to tell that they all work together on.
Mm. Why did you want to create a game with an Indigenous worldview?
So I grew up playing games, and I never really saw myself reflected in them. And then I started working in the game industry back in 2014. It was one thing to not see myself reflected in games because as a person who considers themselves fairly creative, I found ways to insert myself in those games. But once I became part of the industry, I realized that it was a lack of representation within the industry, a lack of accurate representation and a lack of positive representation. So often there were white-owned game companies, especially European-owned game companies, that were putting native themes onto games without any real idea of what they were doing. You know, there are games out there that have a teepee on the same piece of box art as a totem pole. Mm. And natives have to just chuckle at that. But it's a sad chuckle, right? Like, it's that, like, here we go again. We've been represented poorly once again. So I realized that I was this person working in the game industry who had a view behind the scenes. And rather than just complaining to other game publishers, I decided, you know what? It's time to not just badger and complain, but to step up and present a positive portrayal and show what just could be done.
Mm-hmm. In terms of representation and, you know, growing up playing those games, what were you seeing? What kind of characters were there as representation or bad representation.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of role-playing games, the first time I think I even heard Indian mentioned was in a role-playing game called Boot Hill, which was a Western. And of course, you're supposed to play the cowboys in that game, right? And I think the very first thing I did was figure out how I can break that game and play a Native American. I don't want to play the cowboys.
How did you do that? I understand that you hacked into a game to play one of the characters. Like,
Yeah, I think that's one of the first things that happens when you play a lot of role-playing games is you see a rule or you see some content in the game that doesn't quite match what you want it to do. So you kind of just have to go, you know what? I'm just going to take this rule and tweak it. And a good example is in backgrounds. They'll have backgrounds for your games. And it just didn't include native background for your character. That just wasn't there. And so I went, oh, you know what? I'm going to completely write in a Cherokee background. The games are suggestions, not hard rules. No one is going to come and check me and say, hey, you're playing the game wrong, right?
Yeah. And as you were having these experiences, you know, hacking into games to change your character, your background, or seeing these negative representations of Indigenous people, how did that influence you? What was your moment when you were like, I need to take this and change it?
There was a moment where I was coming back from a convention. I saw a trailer, a seat back video on my flight, you know, and I'm going to go watch a movie. And there was a trailer, a commercial for a video game called Greedfall. This game was about an alternate history where some sort of steampunk version of Europe is being plagued by a disease. And they have to go over to this magical savage land to find a cure. It's the worst kind of representation, right? It isn't just bad representation. It was a leaning into all of the worst stereotypes of Native people. And it made me so angry. And I remember thinking, I'm tired of telling these publishers to at least get a consultant on their game. Like, asking for the bare minimum was just no longer enough. Mm-hmm. And I thought, I was like, you know, I'm in a rare position to be working, to be paid on a salary, and to have these connections within the game industry and to know these people. I have an obligation at this point to stand up. It's just not enough to stand on the sidelines.
And so then what did you do? You had this determination now. Your moment has happened. How did you then go about creating Coyote and Crow?
The thing that took me the longest from that moment was, what format do I want this to be? Do I want it to be a board game, a card game, a role-playing game? How do I get both natives and non-natives to go, hey, look, here's something different. Here's something a little, you know, not just more accurate, but presenting a mechanic or a system or a world that is a little different than what people have seen. And I think it took me months to realize that no matter how many ways I tried to approach it, I was going to be forcing Indigenous folks to be asking that question of, how do we deal with the world that you've built in terms of, how do we deal with colonial trauma? And I didn't want Natives to have to deal with that. And the more I tried to pull that apart, the more it came back to the idea of an alternate timeline. And I went, you know what? I don't want Natives to have to face the stuff that we're always having to face every day, with residential schools and missing and murdered Indigenous women. I don't want that to be part of my game. So it took an alternate timeline to do that. And thankfully, I have a big, long history and love of science fiction. And so an alternate timeline was an easy one for me to jump into. But once I did that, I realized that the format almost had to be a role-playing game to start with, because I was going to be creating, by that statement, the statement of creating an alternate universe, I was going to create so many questions that had to be answered, so many what ifs and how did this happen and what was the timeline, that I needed that kind of expansive content and expansive platform that a role-playing game offers to spell out what this world was. Mm-hmm. And so that was a start of a 3-year long journey of writing and development.
Wow, that's quite a journey. I understand you also had, you know, some Indigenous writers in the room helping you create.
We did. Almost from the get-go, I knew that I was going to be, I didn't want to be a lone voice on this book. I'm Cherokee, and I'm certainly capable of writing a good chunk of the rules and perspectives for myself. but I wanted this book to feel like it represented all of Turtle Island. So I began scouting writers from all over the place. We have Wayote Old Bear, who's Numunu Comanche. We have Derek Pounds, who's Samish. We've got people from all over North America to contribute writing to this. And it was wonderful because once I started to get their writing in, I could feel how much this world was becoming more real because they were presenting to me ideas and perspectives that I would have never thought of. And that just made it feel so much more lived in.
Wow. That's amazing that you took writers from all over Turtle Island. What did it take to do that, to make that happen? As a writer, I know it's impossible to get three writers in a room, never mind a cross-section of all the nations.
Yeah, it was a very long process because I think non-natives tend to think that we're all in a clubhouse together, right? That natives all just sit in a single room and talk to each other.
A club teepee, actually.
Right? Exactly. And so for me, finding writers who were not only good at writing this kind of content, but could also leap into this alternate future, it was a long selection process. And it was a long time finding these folks because I think systemically there's a barrier to entry when it comes to natives and modern gaming. It's not an inexpensive hobby. And I think having that kind of expendable cash and the ability to get involved in this hobby by its nature means you have to have some disposable income and some experience in this arena. So for me, it was a long process to find all the writers who synced up well. And I'll be frank, there were times when I was all the way down to doing things like putting out Craigslist ads, trying to find people. I mean, I was desperate. Lots of people interested, but so few people have the multiple skill sets to write for a role-playing game. So it took a while, but I'm so happy to keep working with all of the writers that I work with in Coyote and Crow. They're amazing folks.
And, you know, after you created the game, put it out in the world, did all of this work collaboratively, who is this game for? Who plays it?
It is very specifically for two groups of people. One is, which was my original bar, was I want one native kid to come up to me at a convention and say, hey, I played your game. It made a difference. I loved it. And the fact that I have surpassed that goal by a long shot now makes me so happy. But I did want it to be primarily for one, any group of natives to be able to sit down and play this and go, I see myself in this game, or I can see myself in this game. I can picture my culture existing through this game. But then I also wanted it to go to non-natives. For non-natives, I wanted to create an environment where they could play a game without being appropriative, without being disrespectful, where they could sit down and play this game in a way that maybe gave them not just a better sense and a more accurate sense, but a way that like they could feel like they could actively engage with things that made them a little less afraid of natives. I think there's a lot of fear of natives out there. And the reason I know that is because I still get a lot of white players who say, I'd like your game, but I'm afraid to play it. Because they don't want to be disrespectful, right? And I think that there's a fear, there's that sense of othering going on. They might be respectful of native cultures, but they're afraid to engage with them. And so hopefully that helps, this game will help bridge that a little bit.
But in terms of indigenous players, I was on your website and I saw something very interesting that you had written about.
Yeah.
You know, a Cree player, for example, I'm Cree, shouldn't play a Cherokee character or so on and so forth. Why do you have that rule? I found that very interesting.
Yeah, that was one of those ones that we came to collaboratively, our writers and I, and we were trying to create a scenario where any particular native player could come in and instead of us telling them how their future played out in this alternate world, we wanted to create a sandbox environment where they could tell us. And so I think it was important that natives and non-natives saw this set of rules and this book as a way to talk about their cultures without stepping on the voices or the history of other people. So as a Cherokee, I'm not going to speak to Comanche history or Numunu history or Hopi history or Cree history. That's just not my place. But I think that statement is good for non-natives to see that statement. It's good for non-natives to know that we're listening to each other. I don't honestly don't think a Cree person would try to play a Cherokee character. I think they would probably play a Cree character. But that's great, and that's lovely. But I want non-natives to also see that we're complex, that we're not a monolith, that there are all these internal distinctions and discussions continually going on to this day, right? That our cultures are not a thing of the past, that they are very much a living present.
And in terms of, you know, now that it's out in the world, people are playing it, they've engaged with it. What are some of the reactions you've been getting, in particular from young players?
We have had such fantastic response, both from the general gaming community, but then from spaces that I wasn't even really aware that it might hit. There was a therapist in New Mexico who was dealing with some Native kids who were troubled Native kids. They either had problems at home or had run into problems with the law. She was doing this sort of research with and therapy through role-playing games. She was kind enough to report to me that they switched from Dungeons & Dragons to Coyote and Crow when it came out. And she said it only took a matter of months before she was having to tell the kids it was time to stop playing and to go home because they were enjoying themselves so much. And she reported that all of them connected more directly with their own indigenous identities. And to me, I can't think of a better compliment than that. Like, that's bigger than I ever expected a role-playing game to be. I certainly didn't expect it to do over $1 million on Kickstarter or to be my full-time job 4 years later. I'm so pleased. We've won a number of awards, which is really nice. But to me, the reaction from my fellow Indigenous cousins out there is far more important.
Hmm. Well, what does that tell you about, you know, the need for mainstream or for, you know, these gaming industry to include Indigenous representation and real authentic Indigenous content?
I think it's the same as across any other media that we're seeing right now. And of course, you know, we've seen a great resurgence in television and film in accurate and positive portrayals of Natives. And I think there's just as much starting to happen in the board game industry. I think there are a whole lot of game designers out there realizing now that they have an opportunity to voice their stories in a game format that weren't there before. And I think more than ever, I think there are more Native allies out there saying, hey, we don't just have to support charities. We can support creatives out there. We can support Indigenous creatives because they have something to share beyond traditional crafts. We have imaginations and we have fun things to do and games to play and stories to tell.
Yeah. What kind of work more needs to be done to create space for these games to be out in the world?
I think the hardest part right now is that so many, in fact, I would say the vast majority of creatives that I've worked with can't do this for a living. They are absolutely working day jobs and then trying to squeeze in something creative on the side. I think there needs to be a wider and deeper buy-in from non-Native organizations, sort of non-Native run institutions within the industry. I think they need to start opening more doors for Natives. They need to start providing more grants or more travel opportunities, more ways that help those folks overcome those initial barriers to getting into the industry. Because I think once they see that they're over those barriers and they're able to produce a game, you're going to see this flood of creativity. They just need to be able to pay their rent along the way, right? Like we all do.
Mm-hmm. Like so. We all do. If you could go back in time and speak to that little boy that you were looking for your representation yourself in these games, knowing how far you've come and how far you still have to go and want to go, what would you say to him?
I had all these imaginative ideas. I didn't know there could be or would be a market for them. So if I was going to go back in time, I would say keep creating and get out there because I never thought working in the game industry, I could never make a living doing that. I would just go back and say, you know what? Share your imagination with everybody who will listen. Scream it from the mountaintops.
Mm. Thank you so much for your time today, Connor.
Oh, thank
Connor
you so
Alexander
much for having
is
me.
A game designer and the owner of Coyote and Crow Games. He's a citizen of the Cherokee Nation of Oklahoma. That's all our time on Radio Indigenous. This episode was produced by Elena Hudgens-Lyle, Kim Kasher, Rhiannon Johnson, and Bridget Stringer-Holden. You can now listen to us streaming live on the CBC News app. Just go to the local tab and press play. You can also find and follow us wherever you get your podcasts. I'm your favorite cousin, Rosanna Deerchild, coming at you from Winnipeg in Treaty One territory. Get an Askamit Nawal. Ego say.